Many people believe buying a home requires a large down payment and years of saving, but that's not always the case. Across the country, there are programs designed to help first-time homebuyers take the next step toward home ownership. Some of these programs offer down payment assistance or grant funding that may help cover part of the upfront cost of purchasing a home. Grants are especially helpful because they generally do not have to be repaid. There are also organizations that provide homebuyer education, financial counseling, and guidance to help individuals understand the home buying process before they begin. The goal is simple: to help more families become informed and prepared for home ownership. If owning a home is something you've been thinking about, start by visiting toolsforhomeownership.com. This message is brought to you by the National Foundation for Credit Counseling's Paving the Way Forward initiative.
It's 5:05 and welcome in to a Wednesday edition of the Carolina Journal News Hour on Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Good morning to you. Well, North Carolina lawmakers are not expected to take up legislation again until after the November the 3rd election. This leaves lawmakers with unfinished legislation to act on after voters have chosen the next General Assembly, but before the current legislative terms expire at the end of the year. Because of this, election results are a key factor in shaping what that post-election session will exactly look like. The General Assembly's final scheduled sessions run November 16th through the 19th and November the 30th through December the 18th, giving lawmakers potentially several weeks after the November the 3rd midterm election to finish their remaining work. Mitch Kokai, John Locke Foundation's senior political analyst, told the Carolina Journal, "It has not been unusual in recent years for the North Carolina General Assembly to reconvene for post-election sessions. Ever since Republicans took control of both legislative chambers in 2011, there's been a mindset that lawmakers should not simply leave Raleigh during the summer and let the executive branch do what it will until the following year. Under the current adjournment resolution, which was approved before lawmakers left Raleigh back just a few weeks ago, the November sessions are limited to certain categories, and this will be relevant as we work through the next couple of months. They include things like dealing with veto overrides, legislative and gubernatorial appointments, constitutional amendments, of which there are three on the ballot coming up in November, conference report negotiations between the House and Senate, and bills awaiting one chamber's agreement to two changes made by the other. Mitch Kokai said that lawmakers already have several clear priorities waiting for them, but the scope of the November session will largely depend on what exactly the outcome looks like after the night of November the 3rd. Kokai told the Carolina Journal, "We already know that lawmakers will want to try and override as many gubernatorial vetoes as possible. And there might be some other pieces of legislation that didn't quite reach the finish line before work ended this summer. But election results clearly will dictate how active the post-election session is likely to be." How far Republican leaders go beyond that unfinished business will heavily depend on the makeup of the General Assembly that voters choose on Election Day. He told the Carolina Journal, "If the partisan breakdown of the 2027 General Assembly looks similar to the current legislative lineup, then action on post-election sessions could be relatively limited." He noted, however, if Democrats make significant gains on November the 3rd, then Republicans are likely to push for measures that could withstand a gubernatorial veto now, but would be much less likely to do so next year. House Democratic leader Robert Reeves, the Democrat from Chatham County, warned that significant Democratic gains could prompt Republicans to use the period between Election Day and the beginning of the 2027 legislative session to lock in policies or make additional changes to executive power. Reeves sounding the alarm back just a couple of weeks ago on the House floor, telling reporters, quote, "I'm not a fan of lame duck sessions, and it's not about who's in power or who's not in power. But to me, in November, the electorate speaks. So if you don't like what the electorate's saying, then coming in November and December and thwarting what they're trying to do, I just don't agree with. I don't think it's good government." Reeves pointed to the end of the end of 2016, when Republican lawmakers returned after the election and approved legislation that reduced the authority of incoming Democrat Governor Roy Cooper and made changes affecting incoming Attorney General Josh Stein and the Department of Justice. Reeves said on the House floor, "I thought that that was the meanest thing I had seen somebody do, making him fire people before he got into office. So, yeah, it'll get bad. It'll be bad if a lot of Democrats win in November." House Speaker Destin Hall, the Republican from Caldwell County, dismissed concerns that returning after the election is unusual or intended to circumvent the results. Hall said, quote, "Since I've been here, we've come back in November one way or the other, whether we're going to maintain a supermajority after that January or not. Members of this body are elected for 2 years, and that runs through December, so we'll take advantage of that entire term." One of the main tasks awaiting lawmakers in November will be reconsidering bills vetoed by the governor. There are currently a couple of those outstanding, four to be exact, that are awaiting action when lawmakers return in the weeks following the November the 3rd midterm election. They include House Bill 377, a wide-ranging courts package, House Bill 958, an election measure that would shorten early voting for primaries that would take place in even number years from 17 days to 10 days, just the primary election there. Important to note, House Bill 437, which addresses drug-free zones and unauthorized public camping, and Senate Bill 50, one of the largest pieces of legislation that we have talked about over the last year, which would allow permitless concealed carry across the state of North Carolina. Republicans in the North Carolina House remain one vote short of a veto-proof majority. The chamber has 71 Republicans, 47 Democrats, and two unaffiliated members. With all 120 present, Republicans need at least one vote from the others from outside of their caucus, either a Democrat or one of the unaffiliated members, to override a Stein veto. Mitch Kokai told the Carolina Journal those non-GOP votes are unlikely to support measures that have absolutely zero bipartisan prospects. But Democrats should not count on any help from the members that they helped oust in this year's primary. If the legislature approves measures with supports from Representative Carla Cunningham, Shelley Willingham, or Nasheef Majeed, those measures are pretty likely to become law. Cunningham and Majeed, both former Democrats, switched their registration to unaffiliated after losing their Democratic primaries earlier this year. Willingham remains a Democrat, but also lost his primary. Important to note that those members didn't just lose their primary, but you had, in some cases, the governor and other high-ranking officials within the Democrat Party actively backing up their Democrat opponents in the primary election. The adjournment resolution also allows the legislature to take up existing conference reports, negotiate compromises between the House and Senate on bills that did not make it across the finish line before lawmakers left Raleigh as well. That could bring lawmakers back to the debate over the one of the big topics over the last few weeks, hemp products. We've seen House Bill 328 remain unsolved after the Senate voted 37-6 in July for a conference report that would have sharply restricted the product, all intents and purposes banned it outright here in North Carolina. But House leaders declined to take up the measure before leaving Raleigh. That was in large part due to not fully understanding exactly how many Republicans would be voting in favor. Hall said before the adjournment that the existing proposal was unlikely to pass the House Republican caucus, but he planned to assemble a smaller group of lawmakers to continue working on this very polarizing issue. That could also set up another attempt to reach an agreement when lawmakers return in November. Several bills also remain in conference and could return for final votes in November, including measures dealing with state budget adjustments, Medicaid funding, education policy, health and human services, criminal law, alcohol regulations, health care costs, and title fraud prevention. Because conference reports cannot be amended once they reach the floor and instead receive a simple up or down vote, bills already in conference could give Republican leaders a vehicle to package and advance broader legislative priorities before their current majorities potentially shrink in 2027. Ultimately, this is all going to play itself out on November the 3rd or maybe the very early morning of November the 4th, as election results will determine how much of the unfinished agenda lawmakers pursue and how far Republican leaders try and go before the General Assembly leaves office, which will happen at the end of the calendar year here, the beginning of 2027. It is going to be a very, very short period of time, as we are now less than 70 days ahead of Election Day. Once Election Day is here and gone, it will be a very quick couple of weeks in the North Carolina General Assembly to round out the month of November and into the early parts of December. We will be keeping a very close eye on all of those details. Any rumors that we are hearing, conversations that are taking place, we will pass those along to you over on our website, carolinajournal.com, and as always, right here on the Carolina Journal NewsHour.
Have you ever thought about the difference between paying rent and owning a home? When you rent, your monthly payment helps cover the cost of living there, but it usually doesn't build anything for your future. Home ownership is different. Each payment you make on a home may help build equity, which is the value you own in the property over time. As that equity grows, it can become a financial asset that may support your long-term goals. Owning a home can also provide stability. You have a place that's yours where you can build memories, establish roots, and truly make the space your own. And the good news is that many people are surprised to learn there are programs designed to help first-time home buyers get started, including grants and assistance programs that may help with down payments or closing costs. Learning about your options is the first step toward making an informed decision about your future. Visit toolsforhomeownership.com.
Hey, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Approved. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
It's 5:21. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour, Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT, University of North Carolina Systems. This is the overall UNC system, not just Chapel Hill, have recently told U.S. Secretary of Education Linda McMahon that most of the reforms sought in her call to action on higher education are already policy in North Carolina. In an 11-page letter dated August the 18th, System President Peter Hans and Board of Governors Chair Kelly Hunt Blue pointed to a 9-year tuition freeze, race-blind admissions, and a public syllabus database that is set to launch this fall. McMahon's August the 3rd letter asked university presidents and governing boards nationwide to publish reform commitments by the end of 2026. She said that the requests are a way to restore public trust in higher education, which has slid in national surveys amid concerns over cost, campus protests, and a large ideological imbalance that exists at many of these campuses. McMahon wrote in the August the 3rd letter, "I encourage universities to respond concretely to these questions and provide full transparency to the American people." She posed 7 questions on administration, free speech, faculty hiring, affordability, academic rigor, foreign influence, and service to American interests. The UNC system answered within about 2 weeks of a response to that letter. Florida public universities responded the same day, putting the two systems among the first in the country to respond to the letter from Secretary McMahon. Hands in Blue wrote on behalf of all 17 UNC institutions, including the NC School of Science and Mathematics. The two UNC officials wrote, "Access, student success, affordability, and efficiency, as well as economic impact and institutional excellence, have been our consistent goals through a turbulent chapter of American higher education. Starting this fall, applicants to any UNC school must have a weighted high school GPA of at least 2.5. Those below a 2.8 must also score at least a 17 on the ACT or a 930 on the SATs to be eligible for UNC schools. The letter says that the system has moved towards race-blind applications since the United States Supreme Court ended racial preference admissions that happened back in 2023. In-state undergraduates went 9 years without a tuition increase. The Board of Governors approved the first hike since 2017 in February of this year, capped at 3% and averaging about $125 for new students. With fewer than half of UNC graduates now leaving with student debt, down from 62% in 2017, according to the letter from UNC officials. The system froze administrative spending at an April 2025 level that happened last summer. Since then, administrative headcounts have fallen by more than 5%, according to the letter. And starting this semester, every course syllabus in the system goes into a public searchable database. The UNC system's answers covers UNC Chapel Hill, whose Chancellor Lee Roberts declined to sign the Trump administration's Compact for Academic Excellence last November, according to local news outlets here in North Carolina. Roberts allegedly told faculty at the time, "There's no way we can sign the compact as written, and we don't plan to." He was one of 17 chancellors copied on the Hans Blue letter. The letter claims less progress on grade inflation. The system is deliberating on how best to address that, according to the UNC letter, with Jenna Robinson, president of the Raleigh-based James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, saying that the letter shows real progress, but it shouldn't be the last word. Robinson told Carolina Journal, "UNC's letter highlights the significant progress the system has made over the past decade. However, UNC shouldn't rest on its past reforms. More can still be done to improve academic rigor and viewpoint diversity on campus." The letter closed with a caveat welcoming federal accountability that is clear, lawful, focused on broadly supported public needs and respectful of constitutional rights, state governance, academic professionalism, and the distinct mission of public institutions. Universities and university systems nationwide have until the end of 2026 to respond to the Secretary of Education and Linda McMahon. The Board of Governors for UNC is scheduled to next meet coming up on September the 17th. So we'll see if there is any discussion during that meeting now that that letter has been sent and likely received by the Secretary of Education. We'll keep you up to date with then any back and forth, any response, any additional conversation over on our website, carolinajournal.com, and right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour. In some other statewide news this morning, more economic news as Scotland County is promised a $40 million investment in 43 new jobs in Governor Josh Stein's latest incentive announcement coming out this week. Pressure-treated lumber manufacturer Great Southern Wood NC plans to build a lumber treatment facility at the Loranburg Airport. According to the governor in a press release this week, he said, "We are excited that Great Southern Wood has decided to plant roots in North Carolina. This new facility will strengthen our $41 billion forestry industry and offer more opportunities in Scotland County and beyond." Founded in Alabama in the 1970s, the company operates 16 treatment plants, with the new Loranburg facility set to become the company's 17th. The plant will produce pressure-treated pine and distribute building materials to residential, commercial, industrial, and agricultural dealers in 28 states and the District of Columbia. The project will be partially funded by a $200,000 performance grant from the One North Carolina Fund. The One NC Fund offers financial support to local governments to encourage economic development, attract new investments, and generate employment opportunities. It is important to note that the companies do not receive the money up front and must meet hiring and investment targets to receive that final payment. Local governments are required to match One NC grants, and awards are contingent upon that match. Brian Balfour, the Senior Vice President of Research at the John Locke Foundation, told the Carolina Journal, North Carolina already ranks as one of the best states in the country for business. So this $200,000 grant likely made little to no difference in the company's decision. It amounts to a very expensive press release at the taxpayers' expense, said Balfour. Government should stay focused on protecting property rights and minimizing taxes and regulation on businesses and stop putting their thumb on the scale in favor of specific businesses. Salaries will vary by position at the new facility, but the average salary will be close to $61,000 a year, which will exceed Scotland County's average income of about $49,000 by about 11 grand, according to the press release. So pretty significant there. Unfortunately, as we have seen with many of these business announcements, the press releases come out. There's a lot of fanfare, a lot of positive commentary. And as the project gets close to actually becoming complete, we often see that the projects or the hiring goals are either scrapped or things do not meet up to some of those expectations. So like many of these other economic and business announcements that we have been tracking over the last couple of years, we will keep an eye on this and bring you the latest over on our website, carolinajournal.com, and right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour.
For many people, renting is a convenient option. It offers flexibility and may require less responsibility for maintenance. But owning a home can offer a different set of long-term benefits. Instead of paying rent to a landlord each month, homeowners are investing in a property that can potentially increase in value over time. That means your home may become an asset as you continue to live in it. Homeownership can also provide more control over your living space, from decorating to renovations that really fit your lifestyle. And here's something that many people don't realize. There are education programs and financial assistance options available for first-time home buyers. Some of these programs even offer grant funding that may help cover part of the upfront cost. And grants typically don't have to be repaid. That's why learning about home ownership options can be an important step toward making the best decision for you and your family. To learn more, visit toolsforhomeownership.com.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. Reese, our content agent, wrote the copy based on our best practices, like mentioning Monday.com three times. That was the second. Johnny, our coordination agent, built the timeline and kept everyone aligned. Olivia, our human creative director, stayed in the loop because agents are great, but they don't always know when a joke lands. She had one note: tell listeners it only takes minutes to build an agent. So, minutes. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
It's 5:37. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour, Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Good Wednesday morning to you. We are almost at the time of the year where you will not be able to turn on the television or radio without seeing multiple political ads and multiple commercial breaks throughout a variety of different mediums and platforms. For those that are not inside the process, there are very stringent rules and regulations as it relates to selling political advertising to candidates on traditional forms of media, talking about things like radio and television. An interesting decision out of the Fourth U.S. Circuit has some could have some impacts here in North Carolina. As Senate candidate Roy Cooper, former Democrat governor, is one of the individuals involved in that lawsuit. bring us up to date on the latest this morning. Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour. Mitch, as I understand it, the question here is whether political action committees or other large political groups are entitled to some of the same low rates that political candidates are during the political cycle. What exactly does the Fourth Circuit have to say about this?
Well, the Fourth Circuit says no, that political candidates are, and their campaign committees are the only ones that are entitled to what's called the LUC, or the lowest unit charge requirement within the 2 months before an election. So if former Governor Roy Cooper wants to buy an ad through his campaign committee during the last 2 months before the election, hit that ad gets the lowest unit charge that a broadcast will charge for a for any amount. But that same requirement does not apply to a political party or to a joint fundraising committee with non-candidate members in it. So that is the ruling that came down from the Fourth Circuit. And it's a very interesting ruling. Shorthand is Democrats win, Republicans lose, the Federal Communications Commission loses as well. What had happened was the FCC, its media bureau, published a notice in March that said that political parties and joint fundraising committees with non-candidate members would be entitled to the same rate as the candidates within that two-month period before an election. That was something that was put forward back in March. Roy Cooper, the former governor who's the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in North Carolina, Georgia Senator John Ossoff, Sherrod Brown, who's a former U.S. Senator from Ohio running to get back into the Senate, and a Democratic member of Congress from Michigan, all went to the FCC challenging this rule. The FCC is still in the process of looking into that challenge. But meanwhile, those same four candidates went to the Fourth Circuit and said that even though this public notice isn't necessarily a final order from the FCC, it has the equivalent of being a final order because they haven't taken any action on any other request to deal with the public notice. And the Fourth Circuit, at least the majority, bought into that. The two members of the majority, because this was a 2-1 split decision, both Democratic appointees ruled in favor of the Democratic candidates and against the FCC and also the National Republican Congressional Committee and National Republican Senatorial Committee who intervened in the case, and basically said that no, the rules are clear. This benefit only accrues to the candidates and their committees and not to any other political party or other joint fundraising committee. And so the public notice is invalid, and only the candidates will be able to enjoy those lower rates during the last 2 months. Interestingly enough, the dissent from a Republican appointee, Judge Harvey Wilkinson, said, first of all, we shouldn't have taken this case. We don't have the authority to take this case because we only have the authority to review final orders from the FCC, not this public notice. And then even if we got to the merits, the First Amendment says that you shouldn't have rules that benefit one candidate against another candidate, which is what the current rules do. So a very interesting split in the court. It was a partisan split, the two Democrats ruling in favor of the Democratic plaintiffs, the one Republican ruling in favor of the FCC and the Republican groups who intervene in the case.
Well, Mitch, the timeline on this is fascinating. We are T-minus 70 days until Election Day across the United States. I would imagine there's going to be a lot of scrambling going on as many of these outside groups that we're talking about that are not actual candidates or their affiliated committees have probably already purchased some of these ad buys and have got some of these rates locked in. So I would imagine there's going to be a lot of scrambling over the next couple of weeks to figure all of this stuff out as we get into that 60-day window. But from a political standpoint, this is relevant because we have seen over the last couple of decades less and less money going to the candidates, and not necessarily in terms of the dollar amounts, but these larger outside groups. We've covered a couple of stories over on our website, carolinajournal.com, of large outside groups dumping tens of millions of dollars into races here in North Carolina and in other states. Those entities now will not have the ability to pay this lowest rate, which likely means less ad time for them, their issues, and the candidates that they are pushing in some of those political advertising on television and radio.
Yeah, that certainly could be true. You talked about the scrambling. The date that comes into play here is September 4th. And that's one of the reasons why the Fourth Circuit came out with the decision at the time that it did, is it wanted to have a decision out before the September 4th date kicks in that locks in that lowest rate, that what's called the LUC for the candidates. Now, it's not entirely clear to me whether those who have already bought ads would now have to then go back and pay more. My guess is there's a contract that spells out what they paid, and they've paid it, and it's already done. But as additional ad buys take place between September 4th and Election Day, according to this ruling, if it stands, unless there's some sort of successful appeal, then you would have the candidates would be able to get ads at the best possible rate, but political parties and these other joint fundraising committees would not, which, as you said, probably means less ad time that those other groups will be able to purchase. Now, I think the other thing that we've not yet mentioned is that part of this deals with a different strategy among Democrats and Republicans about how they've approached campaigns. The Democrats typically, and I think this is true in this campaign season as well, have tended to have more money in recent elections in the hands of actual campaign committees, whereas Republicans have relied more on funding the parties and also funding some of these other groups. We saw that there was another recent ruling from the Supreme Court that has an impact on that by saying that the political parties are allowed to coordinate with the candidates. And so that is something that struck a blow in favor of the way Republicans have been doing things in recent elections as compared to Democrats. This is a ruling that seems to favor the way Democrats have been funding campaigns in recent cycles as opposed to the way Republicans have.
Yeah, very good point there as well. Of course, the FCC has been in the news a lot over the last couple of years. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr has been having a very public battle, Mitch, with the ABC television network, Disney, their parent organization, over some issues there. And from a purely outside kind of political standpoint, it has been interesting to see an entity that in large part nobody really ever talks about or really cares about, the Federal Communication Commission, unless you're a licensed television or a radio station, has become almost a household name with as much coverage. And I would imagine this story over the next couple of days is going to get some additional level of coverage on the national media scene and probably point more fun at Brendan Carr and the FCC for what's going on over there.
Yeah, it's likely true. And it also remains to be seen whether this is the final word on this subject. My guess is both the FCC and the Republican groups for members of the House of Representatives and the Senate will be interested in trying to get the Supreme Court to step in and take another action. And one of the reasons why they might do it is the item that we talked about just a few minutes ago with Judge Harvey Wilkinson, the dissenting judge, saying, look, the Fourth Circuit shouldn't have even taken this case. We only deal with final orders from the FCC. The FCC hasn't issued a final order. It's a little bit from the vantage point of Judge Wilkinson, it's a little bit of a strained ruling from the two Democratic judges to say, well, they've sort of acted in a final way because they haven't addressed the Democrats' concerns with a final order. Well, that's not the same as a final order. You can sort of say that it is, but the Supreme Court may take a dim view of what the Fourth Circuit's majority did in this case.
Let's go back as we wrap up this conversation and look at the timeline. I'm sure Brendan Carr and the FCC and some of these other Republican entities that are involved, Mitch, will be seeking some of that relief. Is it fair and accurate to say that this is probably not going to have much of an impact, if any, on this upcoming election cycle? Again, due to the close nature of that September the 4th date, I would find it hard to believe that the United States Supreme Court would act on this in the span of just about a week or so.
Well, it's possible because if there's an appeal, it might be made as an emergency appeal. And all the Supreme Court would have to do, if it wants to step in, would just say to block the Fourth Circuit's ruling. They wouldn't have to go through lengthy arguments, take time to write 200-page decision. It would be one of these emergency docket or shadow docket decisions where an appeal goes up and says, block what the Fourth Circuit does, and the Supreme Court either says yes or no. So that could be done relatively quickly and might be done. In terms of the impact of this ruling on the election, I think it would be in the sense that if this does stand, the impact will be that groups that aren't the candidates' own committees will probably be able to buy less time than they wanted to in the closing days. But all of that remains to be seen. And it's entirely possible that we could see one or two more significant developments in this case just in the next couple weeks.
Well, Mitch, that would be a very different situation from what you and I talk about pretty frequently here on the Carolina Journal News Hour with legal sagas that have dragged out 6, 7, 8, 9 years. So we'll be keeping a very close eye on this fluid situation. We have continuing coverage of this over on our website this morning, CarolinaJournal.com. We appreciate the update. Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour.
Many people believe buying a home requires a large down payment and years of saving, but that's not always the case. Across the country, there are programs designed to help first-time home buyers take the next step toward home ownership. Some of these programs offer down payment assistance or grant funding that may help cover part of the upfront cost of purchasing a home. Grants are especially helpful because they generally do not have to be repaid. There are also organizations that provide home buyer education, financial counseling, and guidance to help individuals understand the home buying process before they begin. The goal is simple: to help more families become informed and prepared for home ownership. If owning a home is something you've been thinking about, start by visiting toolsforhomeownership.com. This message is brought to you by the National Foundation for Credit Counseling's Paving the Way Forward initiative.
Hey, before your Q3 call, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Great. Did you include the differentiation angle the CMO asked for?
Already in there. Three angles no competitor's using right now. Just need your approval.
Approved. Thanks. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
Good morning again. It's 5:54. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour. Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT, as we are now T-minus 70 days until the November the 3rd midterm election. We are starting to hear some rumors and starting to become more clear what the post-election session will look like in the North Carolina General Assembly. Lawmakers to this point are not expected to take up any additional legislation. We are not expecting any more voting days between now and the November the 3rd election. However, according to the adjournment resolution passed by both chambers back just a couple of weeks ago, the General Assembly could have voting days between November 16th through the 19th and November 30th through December the 18th, which would give lawmakers several weeks after Election Day to finish up any remaining work. It is important to note that under the adjournment resolution, these sessions are limited to certain categories and items, including things like veto overrides, of which there are four currently vetoed pieces of legislation that could come back for an override, legislative and gubernatorial appointments, constitutional amendments, of which there are three on the ballot in November, conference reports negotiated between the two chambers, and other pieces of legislation that are awaiting changes from one chamber or the other. House Democratic Leader Robert Reeves, the Democrat from Chatham County, is already sounding the alarm bells that significant Democratic gains in November could prompt Republicans to use that period between Election Day and the beginning of the 2027 session to lock in policies or make additional changes moving forward. Those four pieces of legislation that have been recently vetoed by the governor include House Bill 377, a wide-ranging courts package, House Bill 958, an election measure that would shorten early voting for primary elections from 17 days to 10 days, House Bill 437, which addresses drug-free zones and unconstitutional public camping, and Senate Bill 50, which would allow a permitless carry or allow constitutional carry here across the state of North Carolina. It is seen that depending on what those November election results look like will determine how long lawmakers will be in Raleigh after the election and ahead of the new year. We'll be keeping a close eye on any of the rumor and speculation of that right here on the Carolina Journal News Hour. That's going to do it for a Wednesday edition. WBT News is next, followed by Good Morning BT. We're back with you tomorrow morning, 5 to 6, right here on Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT.
When life gets busy, it's important to reach for the things that help keep you grounded. Enhance your focus with the new G2 Edge Gel Pens from Pilot. Designed to help you regulate restless energy, it features a unique laser-textured barrel and tactile sensory zones that help channel fidgety energy directly into productive flow. Keep your mind calm and your daily routines organized. Find G2 Edge at Walmart today. G2 Edge, sensory by design.